This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatto. This hour we'll be talking and taking a look at what seems to be the perfect energy source. It's clean, it's non-polluting, it's renewable. Nobody owns it. The wind. Wind energy currently powers, a little over a million households in the U.S., and of course that's just a tiny amount, but it's also just a fraction of the estimated wind power that can be harnessed. Yet the numbers are also on the rise. Right now, California, Texas, and Iowa are the leaders in wind production, but new laws in Minnesota could put that state in the number one spot by the year 2012. In fact, Minnesota is expected to increase its wind capacity by tenfold in the next 10 years. Wind power is very big in Europe, of course. A third of the electric power of Denmark, for example, comes from the wind. So what are the obstacles to harnessing the wind? Do you have to live in a windy place? What kinds of changes in our energy production and distribution systems would need to happen before we'll all start seeing turbines? Oh yes, they're called turbines now. Don't call these things windmills. These are not your Don Quixote Holland wooden shoes variety windmills. These are big, sleek machines, some as high as a 20-story building, and they can produce 1.5 megawatts of power, each one of them, enough to supply about 300 houses. And even bigger wind turbines are on the drawing board. Now, some places are resisting turbine farms. You have Nantucket in Massachusetts, for example, where you would expect environmentally correct sentiments to welcome this clean source of power. But Nantucket is all up in arms about wind turbines in their backyard, or really out in the Sound. What do you think? Should we help accelerate the movement toward wind energy? And why did Texas, under the governorship of George Bush, make wind power such a high priority, while the same man as president has not been so quick to embrace this alternative domestic source of power? That's what we're going to be talking about. And if you have personal experience with wind energy, you have maybe a wind turbine in on your farm or your ranch, your backyard, give us a call and share your experience. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK, and I'll do the best I can to talk through this cold. So bear with me today on Science Friday. Let me introduce my guests. John Dunlop is the Northern Great Plains Regional Manager of the American Wind Energy Association, and that regional office is in Minneapolis, and he joins us today from Wisconsin Public Radio in central Wisconsin, where he is attending the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair. Thanks for taking time to talk with us today, Mr. Dunlop.
It's a great pleasure.
You're welcome. Also with us is Mike Sloan. He's the president of Virtus, Virtus Energy Research Associates in Austin, Texas. He's also the executive director of the Texas Wind Coalition, and he joins us by phone. Thanks for talking with us today, Mr. Sloan.
It's a pleasure to be here.
John, how much of a potential is there for wind energy in this country?
One of the nice things about wind energy is that it is very intense. A number of our states can produce many times more electricity than we currently produce, than we currently use in the respective states. And so the potential is absolutely enormous. Our association would aspire to achieve 6% of our entire nation's electricity coming from wind power by 2020.
And what is the potential for, if you go, you know, down the road? Could you make it a lot more than that?
The potential is many times more than that.
Mm-hmm. I've seen estimates that there's enough wind power, if we harnessed all the wind here, to be twice the amount of electricity that we're using now. We could take care
it's
of
at least
that.
It's at least that, Ira. It looks like we can produce about 2,700 terawatt hours or 2,700 billion kilowatt hours.
Mm-hmm. Mike Sloan, I'm looking at a map of the countries put out by the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado. It's a federal research. I'm sure you're familiar with it. And it shows all the installed bases of wind power in the country. And I was very surprised to see that Texas ranks second to California. Texas, 25% of all the wind power installed in the country comes from Texas. Why is that?
Well, when Texas decide to get involved in something, they usually like to do it in a big way, and that's exactly what's happened with wind power. One of the reasons is that it is so cost-effective here. Even though we're a very big state and we have a lot of low-cost oil and coal and natural gas, the wind power, because of the really great winds we have out in West Texas, are also very, very cost competitive now in the Texas market. So it really came on very, very quickly.
Give me an idea of the economics there. If I wanted to put a wind turbine on my ranch, how does that work? Give me a thumbnail sketch of how that would work.
Well, there's two ways to go, and I'm speaking now globally, all over the world. In the United States, typically they're developed by large power companies, and they might put 50 to even, say, 200 of these wind turbines in a big development that's commonly called a wind farm. But each wind turbine costs about $1 million, the very large 20-story tall ones that you referred to before. So not every rancher and farmer has $200 million in his back pocket, so they leave that to the big energy companies. Now, if an individual rancher or farmer wanted to put up one, sometimes they get together in little co-ops and do it. And actually, that's the type of development that we don't have much of in Texas, but they have a little bit going on up in Minnesota. So here in Texas, very big energy projects, and they've resulted in very competitive cost of electricity.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Texans are used to having oil rigs and things in their backyards. Why not a wind turbine?
Exactly. It's really striking if you're ever flying over Texas out west, and when you get around Midland in the middle of the oil patch and you look out the window down there, you can see the wind farms and the oil fields right next to each other, and it's dramatic how similar they are. You've got a wind turbine or an oil well, and they're going to be spaced out very similarly, and they'll have roads connecting them, but you'll still see the cattle running around all of them and doing the normal things that we've done in West Texas before we had wind or even before we had oil.
So how much does a rancher get for having a turbine on his property?
What's typical is about $2,000 per turbine. And we've got one rancher out in West Texas who has about 200 of them on his property. And just working that math, 200 turbines times $2,000 a year, you can imagine that rancher likes wind quite a bit.
He's making $400,000. Is that about it?
That's about right.
And does he have to give up his cattle for that? Or
not at all. In fact, if you look at it and just work it out on a per-acre basis, there's not a lot of water in West Texas. So you need a lot of land to run cattle. And just your gross income you're going to see from cattle operations in West Texas is about $5 per acre. And working out the math on the wind turbine, they're going to make a profit of $50 per acre. So you can imagine they really like wind out in West Texas.
I'll bet. Mike, John Dunlop, Mike mentioned Minnesota. Tell us a little bit about what's happening in Minnesota.
Minnesota actually had the pleasure of leading, as we like to say up here, leading the entire nation in wind energy development during the 1990s. So that was until Texas came along in the late 90s. But during that time, there were numerous laws that were passed in Minnesota in the early part of the decade that led to a leadership position. And actually, Minnesota was number two in the nation until it was superseded by Texas, and then last year, as you mentioned, by Iowa. However, this year, as you mentioned, Ira, the Minnesota legislature dealt with some issues with regard to the storage of nuclear waste. And as a part of that package, we have adopted measures in Minnesota that will, as you say, thrust Minnesota back into a leadership position nationally in terms of new wind energy development. Not only will the laws stimulate the large utility-scale projects, but they will also provide an incentive and actually a requirement to acquire the small utility-type turbines, less than 2 megawatts of capacity that Mike was talking about. We currently have about 80 megawatts of the small dispersed projects installed, and the new legislation would increase that capacity by about threefold.
And there are bigger wind turbines on the building, on the block, on the drawing board, correct?
The typical wind turbine that is going in today in the region is the 1.5 megawatt size or class of turbine. They're, as you mentioned, quite enormous. Typically, they're about between 70 and 80 meters in diameter, so that's well over three-quarters of a football field in diameter, sitting on towers that are over two-thirds of a football field directly up in the air.
Uh-huh. And how do you get the – let me ask both of you gentlemen. When the electricity comes out, is it made to power the local homes, or do you feed it to the grid? And John, why don't you answer that first?
The electricity, our entire electric system in the entire, well, not quite the entire United States, there's an eastern grid and a western grid, and then, of course, as Mike will quickly point out, there's a Texas grid. But regardless if you're in one of those grids, all of the utilities are interconnected together. And so the utilities balance the amount of electricity produced on an instantaneous basis to meet that load. When the wind is blowing, which is the vast majority of the time, especially if you're dispersed geographically around one of the distribution grids, the electricity is simply integrated into that system, and the utility must produce less electricity when the electricity is coming from the wind.
And in Texas, is it locally used or is it fed to the grid there too?
It really is fed all over the state to where people use electricity. And that was one of the, responses to the laws that we had. Back in 99, Texas restructured its electric industry. And one of the things that was important was to make sure that there was some renewable energy in the system. And the rules that they used require electric utilities all over the state to get some very small fraction, about 0.5% right now, from renewable energy. Wind power being the cheapest renewable, that's what most of the companies are getting. So here in Texas, what we're seeing is most of the wind power is going to the big cities, such as Dallas and Houston and San Antonio and Austin.
And is there a stumbling block toward expanding this, or have you reached your capacity? What is the future here?
Oh, in Texas, there's enormous additional amounts. We get about 1% of our electricity right now from wind power, and it's about 1,000 megawatts. That's total installed wind capacity on the ground. We have the potential for 500 megawatts or more, so a 500 times expansion. It's virtually an unlimited resource. It is only limited by the infrastructure and our ability to get it to those cities, which means transmission lines, electric transmission lines to move the power.
And how do those get built?
In Texas, the way they get built is a wind power company will get an agreement with a utility, say in Dallas, that's selling electricity to customers up there locally. We have a competitive market, and there's three major pieces. There's that generator that's doing the wind power or any other kind of power plant. You have the retailer selling electricity, but then a third independent piece are transmission construction companies. And once that agreement is in place, the wind companies will talk to a transmission company and make sure that the power lines get built. But in Texas, the way they're paid for is much like interstate highway systems. It's a public good. Everybody is paying for the highway system. In much the same fashion, everybody in Texas pays for the transmission system. So once those agreements are in place, the transmission lines get built by the transmission companies, and the wind starts flowing to the cities.
Mm-hmm. So it's that infrastructure that we've been talking about that has to get built.
Exactly.
Especially if you're going to move it out of the state and want to send it to the grid some other place.
Correct. We like our wind power in Texas, but we do have this Texas grid, so it's difficult to move the power out of that part of Texas. But we also have some very windy areas, say up around Amarillo, Texas, that are not part of the rest of the Texas grid, and they can't move the power, say, to Dallas very mm-hmm. easily, and they may need to find other places out of state if they want to export power.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back, talk lots more about wind energy, take your phone calls, and be joined by South Dakota Native American tribe that's already installing wind power and see how they're doing with it. So stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about wind power. And my guests are John Dunlop and Mike Sloan. And I know, Mike, you have to leave us, but I have one more question for you.
All right.
As a Texan, you have a Texan in the White House now, and he was the president. Wasn't he governor of Texas during a lot of this expansion?
Yes, he was.
Are you surprised that we're not seeing the same kind of impetus around the rest of the country that followed him to Washington?
There might be different circumstances, but I'm a little bit surprised. The president, I think, did a good job. He was surrounded by some excellent people here in Texas that really wanted to make sure they responded to the desires of customers in Texas. We had a lot of polling information from the late 90s that suggested Texans everywhere wanted more renewable energy. And when the legislature and the Public Utility Commission implemented the rules for the new electric industry, Governor Bush was very supportive in making sure we had a good, balanced program. And it has proven to be exceptionally effective in promoting more wind power development in Texas.
So you're saying he's got different advisors now to these in Washington?
There could be some different advisors. And maybe there are different circumstances. I certainly would hope that the president and the administration would sort of take a good look at what's going on with natural gas markets and energy security and come to the conclusion that there is a very important role for homegrown renewable energy to play here in helping solve some of these problems. And the beauty of it now is that wind is dramatically cheaper than natural gas. In Texas, it costs about one half the price just of natural gas fuel.
No kidding.
So not only can we help solve some problems, we think we can save America some money.
Good news on everybody wins.
That's right.
Thank you, Mike, for joining us. Mike Sloan is president of Virtus Energy Research Associates in Austin, and he's also the executive director of Texas Wind Coalition. Thanks for joining us this hour. I want to bring in another guest. And last month, members of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe in South Dakota held a powwow to celebrate the grand opening of the very first Native American-owned wind turbine. The turbine can power 220 South Dakota homes and is the first turbine in what organizers hope will be a large tribally owned wind farm in the North Plains. Joining me to talk about it now is Patrick Spears. He is a member of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe and the president of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy, which represents 8 tribes in the Northern Plains. He joins us today from Rapid City, South Dakota. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Spears.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Why did you decide to get to install a wind turbine?
Well, as tribal people, we've long been aware of the power of the wind and the blessing of the wind and its spiritual power, its strength. And when the opportunity came around for us and the technology had improved to such a point that it's really efficient, tribal leadership was very much interested in harnessing that power to power our reservation needs and also the export of power to the regional markets.
So are you thinking of going into the power business by building a whole wind farm?
Yes, we sure are. You know, I work with a team of Rosebud leadership. They're under the Tribal Council, but the Rosebud Utility Commission and the Economic Development Committee are the two organizations I work with. I've served as consultant for the tribe for about 6-7 years through the Utility Commission, and then we became associated with DisGen Incorporated, Dale Osborne, who has been developed projects across the country, and we met him through work through the National Renewable Energy Lab, and decided to team up with him and do this project and plan for larger wind ranches in the future.
Now, they say that South Dakota, along with North Dakota, has tremendous potential for wind power there.
It's huge. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory has done some very good maps using satellite imagery and a lot of data that's been collected over the years and currently. And it shows very graphically in colored maps the wind resources in North and South Dakota and the other states surrounding us also. But here's a home to us. So we have Class 6 wind resources, which is about as good as it gets unless you're on a mountaintop somewhere. We have that resource on tribal lands in North and South Dakota from 4 to 6. And enough wind here that's really, these are conservative estimates, but they are huge, to generate over 250,000 megawatts of wind energy on tribal lands alone.
Wow. So can that take the place of casino gambling and income, do you think?
Well, you know, it's huge. As one of our friends that owns one of the more profitable casinos said, though, you know, casino gambling is okay for now. There's jobs there that weren't there before, but it's how you use the investment money and looking at the future. And The quote that a friend of ours said from an Eastern tribe, he says, we realize that our future is really not in blue-haired old ladies pulling the arm of the slot machine. It's in the power it takes to run that machine. So we're looking at a sustainable future, and energy is just a key part to that.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. Patrick Spears is a member of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe, president of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy, which represents 8 tribes in the Northern Plains, and he was on the phone from Rapid City, South Dakota. I'm also talking with John Dunlop. He's here. He's the Northern Great Plains Regional Manager of the American Wind Energy Association. John, interesting to hear that, was it not?
It certainly is. And as Patrick points out, we, as Americans, have done the Native Americans, quote-unquote, a favor by granting them some of the best wind resources in the entire nation. As Pat indicated, just North and South Dakota could produce over 80% of the entire nation's electricity, and a large percentage of the land in those states are actually on Native American lands.
Well, let's stop right there and look at that figure, 80%. What is holding that from happening, holding it up from happening?
Well, as Mike indicated from Texas, in good wind resource areas, which includes much of the Great Plains, electricity can be supplied to the utility at prices that are competitive or below the cost of electricity from any other new power plant, regardless of the energy source. Consequently, we are at a crossover point now, Ira. Over the past 25 years, we have defended the use of wind energy as a renewable resource because it is clean, and it certainly is clean, and it's inexhaustible. But the fact is that in the last 24 to 36 months, we have crossed over that point where now not only is it a preferable environmental source for electricity, but it also is becoming the cheapest source available. And Mike already indicated that the transmission system that was built in this country was really designed to supply electricity to a local load. Utilities would build their power plants near where the electricity was going to be used, and the electricity grid then served that load. As you indicated, we build our cities where the wind doesn't blow. And consequently, the windier areas are some distance from our load centers, and consequently, transmission is a major issue.
So we need to build an infrastructure that could get all that electricity out of the Dakotas, back to the east, or wherever the, you know, Chicago, New York, wherever a lot of electricity demand is.
That is a major need at the present time. We are being constrained by transmission across the country, in the Pacific Northwest, in Texas, in the Great Plains. There are certainly, at some point in time, we will be talking about the prospect of using another means of transporting that energy, which might be to convert it to hydrogen energy that would then feed into the hydrogen economy. But that is in the future. In the near term, over the next 2 to 10 years, we really do need to improve the transmission system.
So where's the politics in this? Who needs to be talked into this?
With the changing economics of wind energy, the politics are becoming, I believe, less important because, indeed, the cost of upgrades of the transmission system can be incorporated into this very competitive energy source. On the other hand, there are people who will literally sit transfixed watching a wind turbine turn slowly in the sky. The current large new wind turbines rotate about once every 4 seconds. It's very tranquil to look at, and they're very pleased by that. However, I have yet to come across anybody that sits and watches a transmission tower. It is not comfortable. On the other hand, I believe that we have established within the wind energy community a pattern for potential development of the utility system. The transmission system as well, because as Mike indicated, a farmer will lease the space above their land to basically, and even in good agriculture areas, double their net income. But they are a participant in that whole economic activity. It's possible that they could receive a revenue stream from the transmission system as well. And this would be a very novel and new area to go into, but it would also, as Mike indicated, if you're receiving revenue from a project, the project looks much, much more pretty.
Right. Let's go to the phones. Lee in Reno. Hi, Lee. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you?
Go ahead.
I was wondering if any research has been done into the dangers posed to bird prey by wind farms. They tend to be prevalent in wind-prone areas. And is this a problem that can be solved, or is it really a problem at all? And I'll listen to my reply off the air.
Okay, thanks. You know, some of these turbines have been accused of being Cuisinarts for birds.
That's a choice word. Yeah, Lee and Ira, the birds obviously share the airspace with the wind turbines. And the projects that have gone in the vast majority of the areas of the country have certainly not been a problem at all. We are very familiar, however, with the first wind energy developments that occurred out in California, in the Altima Pass area just east of San Francisco in particular, that did cause some problems. It turned out that was an area with a high concentration of federally protected raptors. There was inadequate caution at the time. Consequently, some raptors were killed, and it has established the stigma that wind energy is a real threat to birds.
Mm-hmm. I think we have a picture that these things are, you know, spinning like a pinwheel and making a lot of noise. Is that not a correct picture?
That absolutely is not a correct picture. The smaller turbines that you might see on somebody's home certainly rotate at up to 180 revolutions per minute. Current wind turbines, are, as I indicated, rotate up to about 12 or 15 times per minute. A lot of research is going into analyzing how birds react to these perceptively slower moving blades. On the other hand, we have thousands of turbines now installed outside of California, outside of the Altima Pass area, that we can use as a database to indicate that it's not been a problem. And we also have ways of analyzing the avian activity in regions to ensure that we don't have problems with birds.
Mm. Let me go to the phones to Cleve in Wyoming. Hi, Cleve.
Hi, how are you today?
Hi.
My question was... Which companies are really big in producing these type of utility companies, energy companies, or engineering companies? In other words, what do you need to start a wind farm? Is it generators?
Are you interested in this? You have a ranch or something, Cleve?
No, I don't. But I was just wondering. You know, you don't. That's why I want I was wondering, do utility companies want this done? Is this competitive with them?
Good question.
You know what I'm saying?
They're going to fight you on this.
Yeah, if they're set up for coal-fired generators or natural gas or nuclear, do they want a new a new competition in it? And if so, are these real small companies that engineering companies or somebody who makes turbines, or is there a separate utility company in the U.S. that only does wind? Mm. And looking into the future, is wind the best source? And the other, what I was thinking back, the other real, what the nation has a lot of is sun, the solar. Is solar a potential? And, and which one is growing faster? And which one's more efficient? And I'll let you go at that.
All right, thanks. Let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. John, you want to pick that apart a little bit?
Sure. Cleve obviously touched on a number of different issues. One is the development model that exists in the United States. The vast, vast, vast majority of wind turbines and wind generating facilities are owned privately by, frankly, members of our trade association. They sell the power then to the utility, and the utility buys the power from them and distributes it to their customers. Consequently, the financial risk really lies with the private entrepreneurs that actually own and operate these projects. Now, the utility is a crucial part of that, obviously, mm-hmm. since they are the end user of that that service. In terms of the type of companies, they range all the way from the very small, even single-person shops that are involved in the wind energy development, all the way to large corporations such as General Electric Corporation. Manufacturing of wind energy, wind turbines is a... one of the areas where we hope to increase the number of manufacturers in the United States. Uh-huh. Currently, GE Wind Power produces the majority of large-scale wind turbines.
In this country? I found it interesting to note that they, even though they're number one in this country, they're only 25th in the world. Wow. You know, when was the last time GE was 25th in anything?
GE has only been involved for a number of months, so we need to remember that. And I believe that the folklore, at least the common feeling, is that GE only enters into a market if they expect to be one of the world leaders. Currently, by a long shot, the largest producer of wind turbines is Denmark. And many of the turbines that are installed in this country actually come from Denmark. On the other hand, because of the growing market in this country, many of those companies are seriously considering establishing manufacturing facilities here in this country. And one of the major challenges to that is to entice a steady government policy that they can rely on that says to them, yes, indeed, this country is serious about increasing the use of wind energy, and if that's so, they will bring their manufacturing jobs, their manufacturing, including the jobs, to this country.
Very much like the car industry would, coming into this country and building cars here from a foreign company.
To satisfy that market, they look at America and they say, these folks need cars. You're exactly right, Ira.
How does this industry compare to, you know, it's in its infancy to other industries, like the phone company? You know, in its early days, we had a monopoly of the phone system, and you had a lot of, it was broken up, you had baby bells. Are we at that point now here with, like, electricity deregulation at all?
No, we have a ways to grow before we achieve that kind of notoriety. Worldwide, there were about $7 billion of new investments in wind energy. In this country, we pushed a couple of billion dollars. So in the context of the economic activity of the country, obviously it's very, very small.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to have to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk lots more with John Dunlop, who's Northern Great Plains Regional Manager of the American Wind Energy Association. We'll also get the other side of the story from a representative who's going to talk to us about why there should not be windmills out off of Cape Cod. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about wind power with my guest, John Dunlop, the Northern Great Plains Regional Manager of the American Wind Energy Association. And now another wind farm that has been in the news even before it's been built. In 2001, Cape Wind Associates, a New England-based energy company, announced its plan to build a wind farm off the coast of Cape Cod. And since then, resistors to the project have been making their voices heard. The Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound is leading the way, appealing to the public as well as the government to preserve what they consider, quote, a national treasure, unquote. Speaking out against the idea are well-known environmentalists like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. of Riverkeeper and the National Natural Resources Defense Council, who's usually a champion of clean air and water. Joining us now to talk about the Cape Wind Project is John Donnellan. He's Associate Director of the Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound. He joins us by phone from Hyannis. Thanks for being with us today, Mr. Donnellan.
Good afternoon, Ira. Thanks very much.
How can anybody oppose wind power?
Well, that's a question we get a lot, and it's not about so much opposing wind power. We're certainly not against the idea of clean energy. What we're concerned about is the precedence that this project sets of a private developer basically setting energy policy in this country and getting 24 square miles of a public resource for nothing. I think before offshore wind power comes to the United States, we need to really have a conversation on the national level of where they should go, these projects should go, and where they shouldn't go, and there needs to be some federal regulation and oversight.
Well, we give a lot of public stuff away to, well, I shouldn't say give it away, we do license a lot of it to private companies, though all of our airwaves are licensed.
Yes.
And
yeah,
things
well,
like that.
License, that's the key word. The oil and gas industries are licensed and have to pay lease fees and bidding fees. And none of that currently exists for wind power.
So if they were paying you better fees, you'd be happier with that.
Well, no, it's not just simply a question of money. It's a question of responsibility of a private company to a public, the public, for the public good, really. You know, this is one of America's, probably the last great open spaces on the water, and there's no energy policy for wind power that governs the siting of these projects. So it doesn't boil down to just money. It's much more. There's much more of responsibility involved in that. I think the developers need to be held accountable, quite frankly, and currently they're not being so.
A lot of people say it's just a question of it being an eyesore.
Well, I think that's one argument for, you know, an area that's currently just an empty body of water that's really world-renowned for its natural beauty. But, you know, beyond that, I mean, there are any number of specific issues you can get down to in terms of safety and wildlife issues and that sort of thing, as well as aesthetics. But I do think that the big problem that we have and a lot of environmentalists and citizens of the Cape and Islands have is the prospect of a private developer basically taking over a public resource with no accountability. So any number of things you can complain about this project. It's not so much about wind power as it is about responsibility.
So if there were a national policy that allowed this to be happening, then that would suit you better.
Well, yes.
Just like we allow offshore oil drilling.
That's right.
If they were allowed offshore wind farms, that would work for you.
Well, absolutely. A couple of things we don't want to see happen. We don't want to see renewable energy shot in the face because of a project that's poorly sited. And we also we don't want it here because it's too precious an area, but let's put it somewhere else. We don't want to give our problem to another area. What we need to see happen first is the same thing that happened with the oil and gas industries back in the 1950s when they were trying to speculate on outer continental shelf lands, and Congress stepped in and regulated and zoned the coastline for that sort of development.
John Dunlap, you have any comment on this?
It's certainly true that there is a tremendous amount of wind energy resource off the shores of our nation. And as we talked about earlier, Ira, the nice thing about the offshore installations is that the winds are good offshore near where people live. And so consequently, I think that's why John is involved in this project out there, because it is more controversial since it's closer to where people actually live. On the other hand, we have a number of good installations of offshore wind energy that have been operating for a number of months over in Europe, and we can use that as examples about how to site wind energy systems.
Mm-hmm. I think, if I could just stick a comment in here, I think the difference between the American offshore wind industry currently and the European offshore wind industry is that the offshore wind industry in Europe is about 12 years old, and it's proven, and it also, especially in the case of a place like Britain, has a federal government overseeing, or a federal agency overseeing the placement of these things and determining where they should go and where they shouldn't. We don't have that in this country. So, you know, it's not about there being good wind resources. I mean, there are great wind resources off the coast of Massachusetts. No one can argue that. What we can argue is this the right place for an installation of this size?
Well, if you had a national dialogue on wind energy and where to put the stuff, if you had a real cohesive national energy policy, you could stick all the windmills in, you know, on the plains where people would like them to be and get money for them.
That's true.
But we don't have that now, do we?
No. What we have, unfortunately, is private developers sort of cobbling together a piecemeal approach to siting policy, and I don't think that's a responsible way to proceed.
But this private developer has no track record of poor environmentalism, does he?
Not that I'm aware of, no. Yeah. He built natural gas plants in New England.
John Dunlap, did you want to say something? I sort of interrupted you there.
Oh, I'm sorry. You did mention something about the prospect of shipping wind-generated electricity from the plains, and that does go back to this major issue of the billions of dollars of infrastructure that would be required to transport it across the land, as opposed to placing a project relatively mm-hmm. close to the population centers off the shore.
All right, let me go to the phones, get a phone call here. Let's go to Mark in Yarmouth, Mass. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, hi, Ira. My name is Mark Rogers. I'm actually communications director of Cape Wind, the project you're talking about. Hi, John Donnellan.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm well. And I just wanted
to mention, I think you two know each other, correct?
Yeah, quite well.
Indeed, we do. I just wanted to mention that, you know, right now there are 17 federal and state agencies involved in the permitting process for Cape Wind. And their permit decision, if indeed they do approve our project, it will be by invoking the public interest doctrine. And they're doing a full NEPA and MEPA review on this project. We're actually undergoing a more thorough review than any of New England's gas, coal, or oil power plants ever had to go through to get built. And the only thing that worries me about opponents' call for a moratorium on this process until something in Washington happens is that things can take a really long time. I mean, people have been calling for a forward-thinking energy policy in the U.S. that encourages more energy independence and more renewable energy since the 1970s. And yet we've taken only very cautious steps towards that in the last 30 years. And now Cape Wind is offering a proposal that, again, if these agencies deem it in the public interest, will provide three-quarters of the energy needs of the Cape and the islands in average wind conditions.
Mark, why can't you just move it some other place?
Well, you know, John was talking about the European experience with offshore, and it is 12 years. And before we ever announced the Cape Wind project, we did repeated visits to Denmark and to Sweden, where they are now. In fact, the president of my company is in Denmark right now touring some of these sites. And we met with the Europeans. We asked them what the criteria was that's important for offshore. And it's more than just windy. You also need relatively shallow water, and you also need relatively low wave heights to protect from that. If you've seen the movie The Perfect Storm, you get an idea of what an extreme North Atlantic wave can look like. And you just, these structures cannot withstand that kind of impact.
Could you not move it inland?
Well, in New England, you got two windy areas. You've got the Cape Cod and the islands, and you've got the mountains. And we looked at a lot of mountain sites. There's definitely going to be wind projects in the mountains, but there are real problems up there, too. There are areas where the grid is not present, and so the developer would have to pay all the costs to extend the electric grid and to enhance the electric grid to get to them. And as it is now, Ira, there's already some transmission constraints in the state of Maine in bringing down power from there already. So there are some challenges with the mountain projects.
If I could just stick a comment
in here.
Sure,
go ahead.
Also, this is John again. There are also transmission constraints in southeastern Mass, and what we've heard from the folks who manage the regional energy grid is that those transmission constraints will have to be addressed before any new large energy projects are brought online. So I don't think that's an issue that's unique to northern Maine.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about wind energy this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato, talking with John Donilon, Associate Director of the Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound, also with John Dunlop, the Northern Great Plains Regional Manager, American Wind Energy Association. And Mark, I forgot your last name. The Yarmouth, Massachusetts Communication Director for Cape Wind. Do you think that, how is this going to be settled? Is it going to be settled in the courts, or, gentlemen, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think when the permitting agencies make their decision, if they give us a permit, I guess John could answer better. My prediction is they'll probably litigate.
Well, I think we would have no choice but to litigate if the current patchwork of regulatory authority is deemed sufficient by the Army Corps, who themselves does not have the most stellar environmental record, and that's another reason we're concerned about the project. But I find it kind of fascinating that, and I'm not singling out Cape Winds in this, but other projects that are being proposed for the Eastern Seaboard, that these are developers that are proposing use of a public land. They're going to be benefiting from federal public money, but they don't see the need for a federal zoning process.
Mm-hmm. Mark, last word on this.
Well, we're willing to pay a lease. We've said that all along. And if we're granted permits, the government will have the ability to impose that on us anytime they want. I really don't think that's the real issue.
What do you think the real issue is?
Not in my backyard.
All right, thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thanks.
You don't think that's the real issue, I'm sure.
No, as a matter of fact, I think it's one of many. And as I mentioned before, aesthetics is a component of this campaign, certainly, but there are also a myriad of environmental issues. There are public safety issues to consider. This is a huge boating area, and the Coast Guard and just about every boating organization that uses Nantucket Sound is really concerned about the safety hazards posed by these turbines. Mm-hmm. But that all points to the desperate need for some sort of governing authority other than the developers and a few agencies like the Army Corps and the FAA. We mm-hmm. need to have a federal policy in place.
John Dunlop, what about the Great Lakes? Speaking of offshore, the Great Lakes are pretty windy, if I recollect. Are they not?
The Great Lakes vary lake by lake. However, Lake Michigan and Lake Ontario both are prospects for offshore wind energy in freshwater in the Great Lakes. As a matter of fact, we're going to be launching a study of offshore development here just off the shore of Wisconsin, where I'm located, in Lake Michigan. And I think there's some issues that need to be dealt with. Certainly, with the wave action from open water, from the seawater, salt water, is a major issue. But by the same token, ice will be an issue in terms of the design of a wind energy project in freshwater areas.
If you sail to the harbor at Copenhagen, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. You see all these wind turbines out there. And Europe is certainly way ahead of us. Are there any lessons to be learned from the European experience?
You know, I was concerned about that, and I asked some folks, gee whiz, you know, we have these wind energy, or these wind turbines out in the water where we have commercial navigation. What is that a problem? And I literally was told that it is actually an advantage because it helps to define the waterway.
But, John, that's...
And so it's actually a navigation aid.
I'm sorry to interrupt. That's a 20-turbine installation off a major city. That's not conceivably, especially for recreational boating, I don't think that's as much of an issue as it would be at a place like Nantucket Sound.
You're thinking of, what, 130? They were thinking of 130, something like that?
That's right, 130. It was originally 170.
Mm-hmm. We got about a minute left. John Dunlop, do you think that this country is going to catch on to the wind experience here?
I believe that we are just at the cusp of increased development of wind energy in the nation. As we've indicated, wind energy has grown over 32% per year for the past 5 years. The projections are that it's going to continue to grow. And as we indicated, that's primarily because of the competitiveness of wind energy with other energy sources. And I think we can look forward to a whole era of large quantities of wind energy supplying our electricity mm-hmm. needs.
And we thank both of you, John Dunlop, Northern Great Plains Regional Manager of the American Wind Energy Association, and also John Donnellan is Associate Director of the Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound. Thanks again for joining us this hour.
You're very welcome.
You're welcome. Thanks. Earlier, we spoke to Mike Sloan, who is President of Virtus Energy Research Associates in Austin, Texas, and the Executive Director of the Texas Wind Coalition, and Patrick Spears, President of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy, which represents 8 tribes in Northern Plains. Talk of the Nation Science Friday is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer, and our interns are Erica Holland and Annalise Strachan. Why don't you surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can leave us email. You can also get Science Friday's Kids Connection, free educational materials that are built around the program. Also, you can take away past editions of Science Friday on Real Audio Player or listen to them on audible.com players. I'm Ira Flato in New York.